Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guests are Elizabeth Johnston and Robert Brooks of Verrill's Labor Department. And today we're talking about the most important decisions and standards issued by the National Labor Relations Board in 2023. Welcome, Liz and Rob. So great to have you both here.
Thanks so much for having us, Tani.
It's tough because I think in an hour, it's very difficult for us to talk about all of the things that the National Labor Relations Board has done in 2023. And I'm sure that, you know, if we had our laurels, this could be a 4, 6, 8 hour show, because I know that the National Labor Relations Board has been extremely busy in 2023. But I thought it would be really helpful for us to focus in on four of the top, you know, activities or decisions that have come out of the National Labor Relations Board in 2023. And I don't want to say with an eye towards non-unionized workforce, but really kind of as we look at industries in general, all different industries, all different types of employers of all different sizes, kind of what does your average Joe employer need to know? So I'm really excited to talk to both of you about this topic. But as always, for those listeners who maybe have not heard both of you in the past, because you've both been wonderful guests in the past, let's give our listeners a little bit of background about each of you. Liz, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your practice generally?
Of course. Thanks. So I'm an attorney in Verrill's Employment and Labor Group. My practice focuses really on all things employment and labor, whether it be policy drafting, counseling on employee issues, up to state and federal litigation or representation before the Maine Human Rights Commission. So really the full gamut of employment and labor related issues.
Perfect. Thanks, Liz. Rob, let's tell our listeners a little bit more about your practice.
Sure. I'm currently the chair of the Labor and Employment Group at the firm at Verrill Dana. And I have been with the firm about 32 years, and I have practiced exclusively in the labor and employment field. I do a full range of services in this area, including advising employers on how to handle certain situations. I draft contracts. I litigate cases involving human rights claims. And a significant part of my practice is working in the labor law area, which is, as we are about to discuss, regulated by federal law. And this area of law deals with labor unions and employers' rights and obligations with respect to employees and labor unions. And so this involves dealing with union organizing campaigns, so advising employers on how to handle that. This also includes drafting collective bargaining agreements with and negotiating collective bargaining agreements on behalf of employers. And lastly, this area involves handling disputes arising out of the National Labor Relations Act, which could be before the National Labor Relations Board or in court.
Thanks, Rob. And one of the things that he hasn't shared with our listeners, but I am going to toot his horn since he didn't, is Rob is one of the top attorneys in the nation on project labor agreements, which is a subsection of kind of labor relation board type work. And it's always interesting when he has a story to share about his work with project labor agreements. So thanks so much, Rob, for agreeing to have this conversation with us. I mean, we're not going to be talking about project labor agreements today, but I know in the past that you've spoken extensively on the topic.
Thanks.
Let's get into it, though. And sometimes I think it's tough because when we talk about the National Labor Relations Act, which is oftentimes known as the NLRA or the National Labor Relations Board with the acronym NLRB, oftentimes people's mind, I feels like, shut down and they say, nope, I'm not a unionized workforce. I don't need to consider anything that's about to be talked about. Rob, can you give a little bit of background about first why, in part, the National Labor Relations Act and the activities of the board is something that non-unionized workforces need to be aware of?
You bet. So it's useful to remember that the National Labor Relations Act arose out of a pretty significant era in our country's history where there were tremendously disruptive disputes between workers and management. And so for many years, you know, the late 1800s into the early 1900s, union, well, employees were starting to organize and get together and try to better their positions with respect to their employers. And the employers often resorted to some pretty heavy-handed tactics to make employees work or to bring in replacement workers. And tremendous violence, you know, erupted out of these sorts of disputes. And in the 1930s, the Congress decided to try to bring some order to this very chaotic and sometimes violent arrangement by enacting the National Labor Relations Act, thereby creating this federal scheme that applies in all 50 states and tries to regulate this area to provide order and predictability for employers and employees. And so employees have certain rights under that statute. Employers have certain rights. Unions have certain rights and obligations. And so, you know, the basic framework here or the basic right for employees is they have the right to organize, to band together, to bring these issues to their employers when it comes to terms and conditions of employment, like wages, hours, benefits, and things like that. And so employees have an absolute right to do that, whether they have a union or more often than not, when they're banding together, there's no union. And so therefore, every employer who has more than a certain amount of revenue, and pretty much every employer in the country would qualify as one being covered by the National Labor Relations Act. Every employer has obligations to recognize and respect individual employees' rights to band together and form a union. And employees don't even have to form a union to engage in activity that's protected. So anytime an employee comes to you and says, hey, my colleague and I, or I am doing this on behalf of others, so individual grievances are not covered, but it's very easy for an employee to say, hey, I don't like the working conditions here. We all think it stinks. We want more money. We want a cleaner bathroom. We want longer breaks. You know, all those, that kind of statement would absolutely be treated as what's called concerted activity by the National Labor, or by the National Labor Relations Board, which was set up to interpret the National Labor Relations Act and also to administer it. So for that reason, every employer should have some awareness of the NLRA, but I totally understand why many employers would glaze over, because it's a it can be very technical. And the other thing that's kind of frustrating about it, the landscape changes all the time. And we'll be talking about that in great detail today. And one reason why the landscape and the rules around the National Labor Relations Act changes all the time is that it's probably the most political of all the government agencies. The National Labor Relations Board has 5 members, all appointed by the president. 2 of the members are supposed to be representatives of labor, and so they almost always come straight from the labor unions. And 2 of the members are supposed to be from members, representatives of management. So they typically come from various industries, usually lawyers, almost all of them lawyers, coming out of management side firms or companies. And then the chair of the board is the one who's the 5th member and is generally the tiebreaker. And that member is, as I said, appointed all members are appointed by the president. But whenever a new president comes in, they get to appoint who the chair is going to be. And so depending on when individual members' terms end, within a certain period of time of a new president coming in, and especially one of a new political party or a different political party, that majority will shift. And pretty quickly, and it all varies depending on the president. Some presidents are pretty efficient about changing things, and others take a little longer. But within some period of time, that board is going to swing in its orientation to match that of the party that controls the White House. And for that reason, the holdings of the board just swing one direction to the next. And you've always been counting on some variations over the decades. But I would say that in the last several years, when I say several, certainly the last probably 10 years during the Obama administration, and then even more pronounced in the current administration, the board has swung just dramatically. And we'll talk about this in more detail, but they have been reversing precedent, decisions that have been in place for decades, 30, 40, 50 years old. These old precedents have been just tossed out the window and replaced by new rules. And so for that reason, it's an area that even if you think you're not vulnerable to being organized, because it's nobody's ever talked about having a union, you should remember you're covered. And B, you should remember that just because you haven't been organized before doesn't mean people aren't interested in this. And unions are being very aggressive now. They've never had, at least in the years that I've been practicing, they've never had more support from the administration. Indeed, President Biden, when he was running for office, and certainly after he was elected, he announced very publicly, I intend to be the most pro-union president, leading the most pro-union administration in American history. And I can only speak to the last five some odd decades of American history, but in my time practicing law, I've never seen a more pro-union board. So this is a time of sort of new decisions and rapidly changing landscapes for employers. So that's my summary of the NLRB, the NLRA, and where we are in the current political climate.
Thanks, Rob. That's really helpful to take, decades and decades of information and a lot of both statutory and case law and NLRB rulings and kind of put it concisely into a really short statement. One of the other things I was hoping you could help educate our listeners about is oftentimes individuals will hear reference to a ULP or an unfair labor practice charge. Can you just quickly explain to the listeners what that is as we kind of move into the next part of our dialogue?
Sure. An unfair labor practice charge is just the tool used by any person, including companies for that matter, employers, when they want to accuse somebody else of violating the National Labor Relations Act. So more often than not, it's employees and unions that are filing unfair labor practice charges. And those charges are handled by the National Labor Relations Board. And an unfair labor practice charge is a very simple document. It's one page, and it basically says, who's the charging party? Who are you accusing of violating the act? What section of the act do you think they've violated? And what are the facts? And so an typical example is a union, if there's a union in place, will say, hey, we think the employer implemented this change in work rules, and they didn't negotiate with us first. And that violates Section 8 of the National Labor Relations Act. And so we want the board to look into this and, if necessary, charge the employer. Well, if they find that there was a violation of the act, we want the board to charge the employer with violating the act. And then if the employer doesn't agree to resolve it or settle it, they'll have a trial. And the court system, there's a court system that exists within the National Labor Relations Board, and they have administrative law judges who hear these cases and then decide on the merits, issue an opinion, and that that opinion can and that decision can be enforced in regular courts, in the federal courts, to apply them. And if employers or employees don't like the outcome, they can appeal those to the courts of appeal and get up to the U.S. Supreme Court eventually. So that's the general system. But the ULP is the tool or the weapon, depending on your end of the complaint. If you're on the receiving end or the delivering end, if you're on the receiving end, it feels like a weapon. And it's off. So it's used fairly often in these, again, the board offices, and there's regional offices all over the country. There's at least 32 of them, maybe 33 of them. In the Northeast, we've got Region 1. So the number is easy to remember. That's Boston. So that takes, you know, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts. And Rhode Island. And so that's generally the framework for handling disputes under the NLRA.
Perfect. Thanks, Rob. That's really helpful, because I do think that it comes into effect as we talk about the next kind of segment of the show. With that, however, it is time for us to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
At over 150 years old, Verrill has an illustrious history with more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill as one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact Verrill at verrill-law.com. That's verrill-law.com.
As the list of compliance challenges for businesses continues to grow, it's time to think about your payroll vendor as someone that can do more than just pay your employees. I'm Chris Clef, president of Paper Trails. We're a team of fun and local experts purveying convenient, high-tech payroll and compliance services across New England. Whether your business is struggling to stay compliant with an earned paid leave law, you're worrying about retirement savings programs, or you have questions about your state's paid family medical leave, Paper Trails has the team and tools necessary to allow you to handle the work while we handle the paperwork. To learn more about Paper Trails and how we can help your business, visit papertrails.com/HR Power Hour.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-law.com. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today our guests are Elizabeth Johnston and Robert Brooks of Verrill's Labor and Employment Department. And today we're talking about the most important decisions and standards issued by the National Labor Relations Board in 2023. For those of you who are just joining us, prior to the break, Rob gave a really comprehensive background kind of about the National Labor Relations Act, the makeup of the board, political affiliations and how they play a role in everything, and defined unfair labor practices for us. I say comprehensive with the understanding that this is a topic that we could talk about for hours and hours and days upon days, but within the confines of the show, a comprehensive outline. So let's jump into 2023 and what that's looked like. And the first thing I'd love to talk about is a ruling that my understanding is it's related to the CMEX ruling. And it's a ruling that the National Labor Relations Chairperson, so the National Labor Relations Board Chairperson, Lauren McFerrin, who is a Democrat, has stated that it's the most significant decision that's been rendered by the board in her 9 years as a board member. And apparently it came out August 25th of 2023. It was a 3-1 decision. And it resulted in the National Labor Relations Board abandoning longstanding precedent and making it easier for unions to successfully organize workers and be recognized without having to go through a secret ballot election. I mean, Liz, that's my general understanding about it, but can you provide a bit more information about the board's decision in CMEX and why it was so important?
Yeah, of course. So this was a big decision because it really changed the framework governing elections and employer bargaining obligations. And as you noted, it makes it much easier for employees to be recognized without having to go through an election. You know, Rob had mentioned how we're seeing decisions that are overturning very longstanding precedent, and this is one of them. It's turning over a standard that's been in place for over 50 years at this point. So this case involved a situation where there was a union campaign and election, and the employees ultimately voted against unionizing. But the union set forth allegations that the employer had committed unfair labor practices during the election. And so the union sought an order from the NLRB to set aside that election. There were two really major outcomes or takeaways from the case. And the first one is that the board had determined, you know, this new standard that once the union presents authorization cards representing the majority of a bargaining unit and demands to be recognized by the employer must either recognize and bargain with the union, or the employer has the burden to promptly file a petition for an election. The board says that promptly means about 2 weeks. So really 2 weeks after that demand for recognition, there needs to be that petition for an election, and it's the employer's burden. The next big element that came out of this case is that if there's proof that an employer commits any violations of the National Labor Relations Act or commits an unfair labor practice during the election period, the board can reject the election petition outright and require that the employer bargains with the union based solely on the fact that the majority of the units submitted cards. And in the past, the impact of the employer engaging in the ULP would be potentially rerunning the election, but with this new standard, the board can reject the election completely.
Thank you, Liz. That's really helpful. Rob, Liz has touched on it a little bit, but why is this change so significant? I mean, we have the chairperson saying that in the last 9 years, it's the most significant decision that she believes that the board has issued. You've been practicing in this area for a long time. Why? Why is this such a significant change?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, on the, I would agree with Member McFerrin that this is probably one of the most significant change, at least on the issue of you know, how does a union get recognized? This is a sea change. You know, we for years, decades, there's been a predictability to how unions can be recognized by the employees of an employer, and because it's a big change to an employer, to a group of employees, and the board has had implemented processes that made sure that the decision was made appropriately, in the sense that the environment was one that had at least some ability for the employers and unions to get their message out to employees, so that there could be an election that's free and fair and untainted. And so the, you know, for voters, if you will, employees or the voters, again, it's the employees who have an absolute right to bring in a union. They also have a right not to have a union. And that's right in the statute. So the processes were designed to give some time to employees to take in some information and decide how they're going to vote at the end of this period of time. You know, we'll call it like a campaign, if you will. And so the bedrock principle here is that employees have the right to choose, and they're supposed to be able to do it by a secret ballot election. Just like any other election in this country, a secret ballot election that was of this bedrock principle. And so what CMAX does is essentially marginalize or diminish the role of a secret ballot election by allowing a union to walk in and say, hey, we've got 50% plus one of the members of your employees who signed authorization cards. We want you to recognize us. And historically, the employer had a right to say, you know what, we're not going to recognize you. We want to vote. We want a secret ballot election that's overseen by the National Labor Relations Act. And that would then start this process going where the union would say, okay, fine, you don't want to recognize us, we'll file a petition with the National Labor Relations Board called an RC petition. And then that would begin a process, and we'll talk about the process later, because those rules changed, will be changing actually in a month and a half in a significant way. But there was a process, and during this time when the process was working its way through, the employer would have time to talk to its employees, say, hey, this is what we think about unionization, and you know, we didn't know that you were thinking about this, but now that we know, this is what we think. And many employers would say, we don't think a union is in your best interests, and here's why. And that time is really important because by the time a union announces itself, they've already done all their most of their organizing. So they often will do that in secret. The employer's not going to know about it. And so almost always the employer is playing catch up. And so with this CMEX decision, the right of the employer to say, hey, we're going to put the union to its proof. We're going to have a secret ballot election where everybody gets to vote without the union knowing how they really feel. And this is how it should be determined. CMEX reverses that and basically says the presumption is the employees have supported the union. And then if the employer doubts it, then boy, it's the employer that now has to file the petition. It's called an RM petition, not an RC petition. And this 14 day, sort of vague, as promptly as possible, we think it's about 14 days based on the CMEX decision. That puts the burden on the employer to do something. And if they don't do something within 14 days, at least based on this decision, and it's pretty common that, that an employer, at least we trained all of our clients over the decades. Hey, when the union comes in and says, here's our proof that we represent the majority of your employees, we usually advise them to walk away, ignore it. Don't accept that. Don't look at it. But that advice is now out the window. We've got to say, no, you got to look at it. And if you don't see, if you see more than 50% of your employees having signed that petition, then you, the employer, better file that petition right away. Otherwise, you are stuck with that union and you've got to start recognize them and then start bargaining with them. And it's worth noting that once a union gets in, the process for getting them out is somewhat difficult and takes a long time, at least a year, maybe longer, depending on the circumstances. So unions can come in pretty easily. And once they're in, it can be very difficult to get them out. Even if the employees change their mind and say, we changed our mind, we don't want them anymore, they still have to wait, and it could be years. So this is why it's such a sea change for us, just because it really upends this normal process for that allows a little bit of time for employees to get information from the employers about what it means to be a union. So, we can expect that the unions will be taking full advantage of this, and that employers, especially ones that are uninformed, if they don't know about that 14-day window, boy, they miss it. They don't file that petition for an election in time, and they're stuck. The next thing they know, they're at a bargaining table with the union and trying to work out a collective bargaining agreement.
Perfect. Thanks, Rob. Liz, Rob's kind of touched on it a little bit, but what are some of the lessons that you would say that employers need to have based off of this decision?
Yeah, I think there are a few key ones. One is, really related to that short time window that Rob, just emphasized there, is really taking advantage of the opportunity to campaign if the employer is trying to avoid being unionized, and campaign earlier rather than later in the process. Sort of relatedly to that, it's also a good idea to put some steps in place before before your organization's even at that point. Make sure that your managers know what to do, what not to do in a situation where employees are organizing, and in case there needs to be an election in a relatively short period of time. In a lot of cases, an organization might not even be aware that employees are in this process or signing cards until they're presented with them. So it's important to have some training and procedures in place ahead of time, rather than trying to start from zero after you're being thrown into the situation. Also, relatedly to the election and being in this process, particularly with the impact of engaging in an unfair labor practice, it's really a top priority for employers to make sure that they're acting in a manner that's compliant. And again, that managers and people on the ground are trained and know what they should not be doing and, doing as well, so that the employer isn't found to be engaging in something that would risk the election.
Perfect. Thanks, Liz. That's really helpful.
I want to pile on with one more point about this CMEX decision, and namely that even if the union loses the election, and Liz certainly touched on this at the beginning describing the case, one of the other key takeaways here that makes the CMEX decision really helpful for unions is that even if the union loses the election, if they can assert that the employer committed some unfair labor practices during the election, and those unfair labor practices are often in the eye of the beholder, You know, the employer will say, hey, I didn't do anything wrong. I was just telling employees what their rights were under the union. And yeah, the fact that I mentioned that the plant, you know, or the employer might close if the union comes in, that's just an economic reality. You know, if the union wants more money than we have and we can't make ends meet, we're going to go out of business. I was just telling, you know, that's just the way it is. And the union would say, no, they threatened to, the employer threatened to close the business if we brought the union in. And so with those facts, the union could file an unfair labor practice charge against the employer for essentially interfering with the employee's free choice of a union. And if the administrative law judge agrees with the union, then under the old standard, essentially just rerun the election, as Liz said. But under this new standard, that hypothetical I just gave you could very likely and almost certainly would lead to the administrative law judge saying, you know what, the employer kind of forfeited their right to have an election, and we're going to order them to bargain with the union. And so even though the union lost the election, we're going to pretend as though they won because the employer, you know, gamed the system with the election by threatening employees in my example. And that, that may sound like, well, I didn't do anything wrong. I'll defend myself. I can count on the judges to be fair and impartial. And I'd say many of the judges at the board are fair. They try to be, but they're also obligated to follow the precedent of the board, the NLRB, that 5-member body that's very political. And so their hands can be tied. And I think that the reality is that there'll be a lot more situations where the hearing officer or judge, rather, would order the employer to recognize the union because of an unfair labor practice that the employer was accused of committing.
Clearly a lot kind of going on with that decision. I mean, Liz, right before that decision, my understanding is the board had issued a decision called Stericycle. What did that decision hold? Kind of switching gears to another really big case that has occurred in the last couple of months.
Sure. So Stericycle was another decision from August of this year. And as it really relates to how the board evaluates workplace rules and workplace policies when those rules and policies are challenged for violating employee rights to engage in protected activity under the National Labor Relations Act. So it's changing the standard of how the board looks at whether there's a violation by the employer. So under the pre-Stericycle standard, the board would essentially use a balancing test to weigh employer interests and justifications for workplace rules and policies with whether those policies could have a chilling effect on employee Section 7 rights. And that analysis gave some deference to the employer and its business interests in having those rules and policies in place. In Stericycle, though, the board held that, you know, the prior standard is allowing employers to get away with a little bit too much and adopt rules that were not really giving enough consideration to how they're impacting employees' abilities to engage in their right protected activity. So under the new standard, basically employers can have workplace rules so long as they are, quote, narrowly tailored to advance legitimate and substantial business interests and minimize the risks of interfering with worker rights to act collectively. So it's definitely a mouthful, but in short, what that means is if a workplace rule could be reasonably interpreted as restricting employees' Section 7 rights, even if the employer didn't intend to do that or intend for the rule to have that impact, then the rule is going to be presumptively unlawful. So, you know, if that was the case, then an employer can rebut that with evidence that the rule or policy has a substantial business interest aspect to it. But the board's going to be much more critical of if there's a less restrictive way to advance that interest, then the employer needs to go with that.
Perfect. Thanks, Liz. We're at that time. We do need to take a quick break. You've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Educational HR Radio is critical to your organization's success, and our sponsors understand the value this program brings to owners, C-suite professionals, and the HR community. We are honored to thank our sponsors for their support and contributions to this program. We thank the law firms of Verrill, Jackson Lewis, and Sheehan Finney, along with our partners, Paper Trails and Strategic HR. Want to be the next sponsor of the HR Power Hour? Text 603-303-6124 and say HR Power Hour sponsor.
It's 6:42 p.m. Time for Steve Plato and his son Dylan to do the dishes. They talk about everything from the yuckiness of girls to the awesomeness of his soccer team. Sometimes they don't talk at all. Then, hey, the dreaded splash fight. It's dad o'clock, and it's the best time of the day. Because the smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guests are Elizabeth Johnston and Robert Brooks, attorneys in Verrill's Labor and Employment Department. And today we're talking about some of the big decisions that have come out of the National Labor Relations Board in 2023. Prior to the break, Liz was describing the Stericycle decision and what it means to employers, workplace policies, and rules. Rob, one of the things that Liz mentioned was that policies had to advance legitimate and substantial business interests. Do they give us any more about what that could mean, or are employers left to kind of guess at what that's supposed to mean?
Great question. Well, it's the latter. It's guessing, I think, is probably the short answer to your very good and pointed question. You know, as an employer, you're probably scratching your head and you're thinking, well, okay, so this is balancing test and I'm supposed to weigh the employees, you know, rights under the National Labor Relations Act to engage in concerted activity. And I weigh that against my legitimate interests as an employer in promulgating policies. And, you know, so this question of, well, what's a legitimate and substantial business interest? And you're like, well, every single one of my policies in my handbook is advancing a legitimate business interest. Otherwise, it wouldn't be in my handbook. Duh. That's why we have policies, to advance our legitimate business interests. And so it's been maddeningly frustrating for employers over the years, because this is one area in particular that has just gone back and forth depending on which party controls the White House. And so I think the oscillation has started to get really pronounced during the Obama administration, when the rules were really swung more in the pro-protective of employees direction. With the Trump administration, the rules swung back to the prior rule, which had, I think, more deference for the employer in articulating their policies. And then, you know, the within less than 24 hours of Joe Biden being inaugurated as president, he fired the sitting general counsel of the board, who was the sort of the chief prosecutor, if you will, for the board, and one who really leads the charge in enforcing the board and the act, rather. And so the general counsel, Rob, was, again, gone within 24 hours of Biden being elected or inaugurated, rather. And his replacement, Jennifer Abruzza, is a very, you know, came out of the unions, one of the union lawyer, and had been in the Obama administration, and she's been very, very aggressive about going back to the Obama standard, but even a little extra. And so one of the things that's really important to note here in terms of who gets to decide what's the right balance, the view of the general counsel is that essentially it's a rule unlawfully restricts an employee's Section 7 rights if an employee could reasonably interpret it to have a coercive effect on sort of chilling their rights, you know, so rights under the National Labor Relations Act. So if you have a dress code policy that says you can't wear any buttons or pins, unless they're approved by the employer. It's part of our dress code. Well, an employee, not like most or most reasonable employees, but an employee. So if anyone, even the most timid or confused or, you know, whatever, an employee could view that policy as saying, what we really mean, even though we didn't mention union pins in here, what we really mean is you can't wear any union pins because we don't want you to organize. So if an employee could interpret the policy as interfering with their ability or rights to bring in a union, that's unlawful, even if no employer or the employer has never tried to enforce it that way. And so that employee, you know, or the board on its own could file a charge, an unfair labor practice charge against the employer on that, what the board would say is a facially unlawful policy, and say that doesn't legitimately advance your business interests, and you're guilty of violating the act. You have to rescind that policy.
Gosh, well, considering that, Robin, you know, thank you, because for something that, you know, isn't defined, I think it's defined massively broadly, or could be defined massively broadly. I mean, Liz, considering that, what should employers be doing or considering as a result?
I think there's a couple proactive steps that employers can take, and given the Stericycle decision, one being take a look at your policies and your rules. You know, Rob was talking about dress code policies and how those could be a potential violation, you know, even though they're facially neutral. So look at your confidentiality policies, social media policies, codes of conduct. You know, if there's any restrictions that you have on discussing pay, discussing, you know, working conditions, of course, or anything else that could be considered protected by Section 7, make sure that your policies are being adjusted or are narrowly tailored enough to protect your organization, but also not cross that line into being considered risky under the board's decision. A second thing is, you know, when you're faced with disciplinary decisions, termination decisions, employee issues, be mindful of what's underlying those decisions. Is the reason for the discipline or termination potentially protected under Section 7 or a policy, or, you know, based on a policy that could be considered unlawful under Stericycle? Make sure to take that time and think about whether it's appropriate to be enforcing that in light of the board's decision. It's been a really busy year thus far with the board, and it's likely that we'll see more and more challenges to employer policies. So, you know, having this knowledge that this is an issue at the forefront is, you know, great to keep that at top of mind.
Yeah. And just to add on to what Liz just said, I think there are, you know, many employers maybe frustrated because they're saying to themselves, God, I just changed my policies a couple of years ago when you guys issued your last bulletin about the previous decision that on this issue, and that was reversing the Obama administration policies where I changed my policies, you know, back then too. So why don't I just wait this out? You know, can I wait this out till the next administration comes in and maybe it's a different political party and then I don't have to do anything? You could do that, but there's a risk. And I think every employer has to measure their own risk tolerance and decide for themselves, you know, perhaps what are the most likely areas that they're going to be tested on, and, you know, how likely is it that this is going to come up? I'd say the risk of these things coming up, ULPs coming up, have gone up significantly in the last couple of years. But again, this is one of those areas where I think there's a lot of judgment that can be applied by employers to decide how much and how extensively to respond.
So definitely some really big decisions there in August. I'd like to turn us back a little bit and bring us kind of rewind the clock a little to February 2023, when the NLRB issued a decision in McLaren-Macomb, holding that certain confidentiality and non-disparagement provisions that are common in employee severance agreements violate the National Labor Relations Act. Why does the National Labor Relations Board believe these provisions violate employee rights? And I'll throw it out there to kind of whoever would like to jump on that one.
Sure. So I'll get us started on that, Tani. So this case really attacked some very common provisions that we see in a lot of severance and separation agreements. The case looked at provisions that restricted the ability of the employee to talk about the agreement itself and also talk about the employer or disparage or say harmful things about the employer to other employees or the public. And the board found that those terms infringed upon employees' rights under the NLRA because, you know, it was such a broad restriction on their ability to speak about the terms and conditions of their employment and their employer generally. So, you know, a key piece of this decision is going to mean that employers need to revisit their separation and severance agreements and tailor their language down to make sure that confidentiality and non-disparagement provisions are not so broad to be preventing employees from speaking about things that would be otherwise protected activity under Section 7.
Thanks, Liz. That's really helpful, especially because, you know, I think that the NLRB General Counsel made some really broad statements in a memo shortly after the decision came out, and it left a lot of employers scratching their heads about, are we not allowed to have confidentiality? Are we not allowed to have non-disparagement? So that is helpful to get a little bit of a better understanding about where we're at. We are at that time again, though, that we need to take another quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
As the list of compliance challenges for businesses continues to grow, it's time to think about your payroll vendor as someone that can do more than just pay your employees. I'm Chris Clef, president of Paper Trails. We're a team of fun and local experts purveying convenient, high-tech payroll and compliance services across New England. Whether your business is struggling to stay compliant with an earned paid leave law, you're worrying about retirement savings programs, or you have questions about your state's paid family medical leave, Paper Trails has the team and tools necessary to allow you to handle the work while we handle the paperwork. To learn more about Paper Trails and how we can help your business, visit papertrails.com/HRPowerUp.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
We're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today our guests are Elizabeth Johnston and Robert Brooks of Verrill's Labor and Employment Department. And today they're talking about the most important decisions and standards that were issued by the National Labor Relations Board in 2023. Rob, we only have a few short minutes left, but I think it's actually the perfect amount of time for us to talk about what I think many people would call one of, you know, the other big decisions that have come out of the National Labor Relations Board this year. And that was going back to August, adoption of a final rule for elections and changing the NLRB rules that had been in effect under the Trump administration to a new set of standards. Can you give me a little bit of better understanding about what that change was and the effect that it has on employers?
Sure. This is another one of those issues that have gone back and forth depending on which party controls the White House. And you may remember I mentioned at the beginning of our talk how important it is for there to be sufficient time between when an employer knows about the union's interest in representing its employees and when the election is. And for a lot of reasons, mostly strategic, unions don't want a lot of time between when the petition for an election is filed and when the election is actually held, because they usually view that they're going to lose support during that period of time as the employer undertakes its information campaign. And the so the amount of time that elapses between the, again, the filing of a petition and with the board for an election and when the election happens is one that has been sort of somewhat flexible. But generally speaking, for many decades, you know, you could usually count on about 30 to 40, maybe 50, 60 days for an employer to talk to employees. During the Obama administration, they issued some rules that shortened it to maybe 25 or 30 days, generally speaking. And then during the Trump administration, the board issued rules that lengthened it. And the rules that were published on August 24 of this year, which will become effective on December 26th of this year, 2023. So they're not yet in effect, but in general, they essentially, across the board, at every procedural step in this process, they shorten the time. And so, you know, things like eight business days for the employer to get information to the board now become 7 calendar days. So they eliminate weekends and take a business day out. So again, I think the net result of this is that employers will have, you know, maybe 2.5 to 3 weeks, if that, between the time that a petition gets filed with the board to hold an election and when the election happens. And so that just means there's even less time for an employer to educate their workforce, which, to Liz's point a minute ago, really important for employers if they're worried about union organizing or even just mindful of it. Prepare, educate your supervisors, think about your policies that relate to dress code, confidentiality, attendance, things like that, that unions really care about, and get out in front of this, because if you wait too long, it may be too late. So those are the quickie rules in a nutshell. So as of December 26, 2023, the rules will change significantly to, again, result in what's called quickie elections.
Thanks, Rob. That's super helpful. I mean, if both of you were to provide one tip for employers, kind of based off of what's been happening with the NRIB this year, what would that tip be? And I know I'm catching you both off guard, especially considering kind of how many big things that there are that have happened this year, but maybe just one takeaway. And it doesn't have to be from both of you, but just one of you, what would you say is really important right now?
I'll jump in. I think my biggest tip would be to not think that this could never happen to you or that this won't matter for you just because you don't currently have a union or you're not in an industry that typically, you know, you see being unionized. We're seeing more and more industries, that are being involved in this. And it's that much more important to stay ahead of what's going on at the board level and what your obligations might be, no matter what your industry is.
And on a related point, I would do supervisor training. If you even think about that there's a risk that you could be organized, and heck, that's pretty much every employer now, then do the bare minimum. Get your supervisors trained on what the rules are concerning how not to violate the National Labor Relations Act, and then update that from time to time, because your supervisors are your eyes and ears out there, and they're the ones who will need to be trained to be on the lookout for signs of organizing.
Thank you both so much for those thoughts and just for your time in general today. I really appreciate it. So thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.